All right, this morning we have two cases on our 9 o'clock docket. We'll go through both of those, then we'll probably take a 10-minute recess before we pick up the 10 o'clock docket. All right, Ms. Bezek.
May it please the court, Mr. Watts will argue for appellant, Mr. Jeff Coates will argue for appellee.
Good morning.
Good morning.
This case involves a very tragic and untimely death of a sheriff friend at the city's water park. She collapsed from a heart condition while waiting in line at one of the water rides at the park. There were two automatic external defibrillators located at the water park. However, Sarah Friend did not receive defibrillation until about 21 minutes after she collapsed, after when the North Richland Hills Fire Department showed up. For the reasons I've stated in the opening brief, I'm just going to get to the Tort Claims Act exceptions. Essentially, for the reasons stated in my brief, regardless of how you get there, you have to allege a waiver of immunity under the Tort Claims Act. There are a number of exceptions, of course, in the Tort Claims Act, and how those work is the tort, you know, there's governmental immunity. The Tort Claims Act pokes holes in that immunity. To the extent there are exceptions to the act, it makes those holes smaller or covers them back up partially. The section that I'm arguing states that the Tort Claims Act, in other words, the waivers don't apply from the action of an employee while responding to an emergency call or an emergency situation if the action is in compliance with the laws or ordinances applicable to the emergency action, or in the absence of those laws, the action is not taken with conscious indifference or reckless disregard. Under the pleadings of this case, clearly they're employees. Clearly this is an emergency situation. There are no ordinances or laws specifically applicable that have been alleged by the plaintiffs. And I don't see how, under this case, you could get to reckless indifference or conscious disregard. That standard is satisfied when a party knew of relevant facts but did not care about the result. Essentially, what the allegations in this case boil down to are essentially where the AEDs, the automatic external defibrillators, were located at the water park in relation to where Sarah Friend eventually collapsed. I do not understand how placing them at a certain location is going to be conscious indifference or reckless disregard when the city had absolutely no way of predicting where a cardiac emergency or a cardiac arrest would occur. And again, another allegation is that the city used tangible personal property when it called for emergency equipment on a radio. Again, I don't see how calling for the emergency equipment, whatever piece may have been missing, can rise to the level of conscious indifference or reckless disregard. To avoid the application of this exception to the Act's waivers of immunity, appellees have essentially asserted that they don't have to allege things to avoid application of the exceptions. All they have to do is not address them, and it's our job to prove that they apply. Well, the Texas Supreme Court has recently dispelled with that and essentially said it's their burden to plead and prove that the exceptions do not apply. And in this case, they have pled facts that essentially show that this exception to the waivers apply.
But Mr. Quest, in the Miranda case, which was also an emergency case involving recreational facilities. It was involving recreational facilities and gross negligence with a tree limb falling on the child's head.
Yes, absolutely.
The Supreme Court said it's the state's burden to produce evidence on that exception.
Your Honor, what that goes to is essentially gross negligence under the recreational use statute. What we're talking about here is the application of the emergency response exception. Under the recreational use statute, they still have to allege something that rises to the level of gross negligence. I don't think we have that in this case because, again, gross negligence requires subjective awareness of a risk and a disregard of that risk. And again, in this case, the main allegation is we place the AEDs or remove them to some other place on the park or had them in a place to where they couldn't be brought to where Sheriff Friend was in a timely manner.
So you're saying they didn't allege that?
Well, their allegations, but I don't see how that can rise to the level of gross negligence. Because, again, we would have to have a crystal ball to tell us we know that an emergency is going to arise on that spot at the park, so we need to put AEDs and other emergency devices close to them.
But my question is, you're saying that those allegations of that placing them where they wouldn't be available to her, whatever, that doesn't rise to the level of...
It does not, and it is clearly their burden to allege facts which, at first glance, satisfy gross negligence.
Because you said proof earlier, that it was their burden to prove it, and it seems to me that notwithstanding Justice Brister's statement in the Hartman case, that you have to go back to Miranda and look at, and he cites Miranda, and see that a plaintiff surely doesn't have the evidence, the burden to come forward with evidence at this stage that would convert the plea to the jurisdiction into a no-evidence summary judgment motion.
Justice Gardner, let me be clear about what we're dealing with in this case. Miranda essentially said, the trial court has to deal with a plea to the jurisdiction at the earliest possible stage in the proceedings. However, a government can essentially negate factual allegations of jurisdiction by essentially a procedure which amounts to a summary judgment. What we're doing here is there's no evidence.
But that's a no evidence summary judgment, and the court in Miranda said a summary judgment under 160AC, which is a traditional motion for summary judgment, and that the state had the burden of proof.
Well, Your Honor, but traditionally, pleas to the jurisdiction could just say, look at their pleadings, it's not enough. There are three different types, in my mind, pleas to the jurisdiction. Well, two. In other words, you can move for a plea to the jurisdiction based solely on the pleadings. In other words, you can just say, court, construe the pleadings liberally, look at the pleader's intent. And essentially what we're saying in this case is, without evidence, just looking at the pleadings alone, it's not sufficient to raise an exception to the Tort Claims Act, to get around the exception to the waiver, to allege gross negligence under recreational use. None of those things exist under these allegations. The other type of plea to the jurisdiction is the government submits evidence to disprove something they've alleged, and then if they negate it, then it's their burden to come back with evidence to raise a fact issue. That's not what we're doing here. We're just looking at the pleadings. The pleadings are construed in their favor, but it's our position, of course, that the pleadings absolutely do not satisfy the standards that they need to.
Okay.
So you're saying that it's their job to guess what defenses you are going to raise and then meet those defenses in their pleadings?
Yes. The defenses that are, well, let's not call them defenses. They are exceptions to the waivers in the Act. Now, there are cases, there are older cases that say, and it certainly makes sense to me, that if you're talking about exceptions to a waiver of immunity, that's a defense that a city needs to raise or government needs to raise. But clearly, the Supreme Court in the City of San Antonio versus Hartman has made it clear that these are things, avoiding these waivers, excuse me, these exceptions to the waiver, are matters that the plaintiffs have to plead and prove to avoid.
Can you talk about the condition of the property and why location of the AEDs is not a condition of the tangible personal property?
Absolutely. Well, there's two different things there. First of all, is the location of the AEDs on the park, is that considered a premise defect? And I don't think it is. A defect is defined as an imperfection, shortcoming, or something necessary for completeness of a building, the grounds, or appurtenances thereto. That's the Nunez versus City of Sansom Park from this court. Appellee has not alleged anything that is wrong with the premises of the water park itself. Appellees, in their first footnote of their brief, they cite a litany of cases, essentially for the general proposition that, yeah, this is a premise defect. Well, if you look at the cases closely, they deal with more of the question of the distinction between a ordinary premises defect and a special premises defect, not whether this is a premises defect or not. On my reply brief at page 10, I'm not saying this is a exact science or these are precise concepts, but essentially there's been some factors that cases have identified to distinguish between whether something is a premise defect or does not. Are we talking about a distinct piece of equipment? Is it permanent or temporary? Does the equipment serve a particular purpose? In this case, these automatic defibrillators are clearly movable. That's their purpose, is to be movable. They serve a particular purpose. The reason why they're placed at the park is for these particular types of situations. The Court of Appeals opinion in the Retzlaff case, the allegations there were that an inmate was injured by razor wire on a fence, and he alleged that it was a premises defect because it was a dangerous condition, and certainly it was. The court was of the opinion that it's not a premises defect because the razor wire is doing what it's supposed to, and that's precisely what the AEDs were doing in this case. As for the conditions of...
How do we know that? And what were they supposed to be doing? Weren't they supposed to be defibrillating?
Excuse me, Your Honor?
How do we know they were doing what they were supposed to? I thought they weren't used, and thought it wasn't until the fire folks got there that they were used.
Well, Your Honor, but they were placed at a particular position on the property. Again, we're talking about a premises defect.
Okay, so their job was to be at a particular place, and they were at that particular place.
Exactly. Precisely. They were placed at a particular location for the purpose of being available for an emergency situation.
But it wasn't?
It was. They were located on the park, but their allegations seem to be that, well, it wasn't close enough to where the accident or the incident eventually happened, or that it was used to be there, but it was moved. But again, how could we foresee where the incident is going to take place?
I mean,
are we going to impose a duty on city?
And they didn't know where it was? Or I'm confused.
Your Honor, I will be very honest with you is that the pleadings don't address those issues, and I have not been involved in the discovery in this case, and I thought it best to stay that way for the purposes of attacking solely the pleadings on this appeal.
Okay.
But we don't know. We don't know. But their allegations are in this case is that essentially the location of the AEDs at the park are premise defect. That's not a condition or shortcoming or something wrong with the park itself. As for the condition of tangible property, two pieces of tangible property we're talking about here are essentially the defibrillators themselves. And there's also an allegation that the city used a radio when it called for necessary resuscitative equipment after Sarah Friend had collapsed. Appellees have argued or alleged, excuse me, they've argued this in their brief, that the city used the defibrillators when they moved them from being close to this ride where she collapsed to another place on the park. Well, again, this isn't rocket science. What is the common and ordinary understanding of the term use? A use is putting something or bringing it into service or employing them for a given purpose. Okay, if I'm moving them from one storage place to another, can I be said to be using them? Hey, what are you doing with those defibrillators? Oh, I'm moving them over here. So you're using them? No, I'm putting them away over here. This isn't difficult. They've also alleged, you know, most of the allegation in this case can be boiled down to the fact that the AEDs were not used. Okay, that is a non-use of tangible personal property. Clearly not, doesn't fall within the waiver of immunity. With respect to conditions of the radio, conditions of the defibrillator, there's no allegations that those specific items were defective or that they were there was something wrong with them. Last thing I want to hit on is, of course, the city did use the radio, but essentially the problem there is that there's not sufficient causation. Now, they make the point that causation should be something for a jury. No, I'm sorry. That's all my time. Unless the court has any questions, I'll be quiet.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Quas. Mr. Cobes.
Thank you, Your Honor. It pleased the court. I'm going to back up just a little bit, make sure everybody understands where we are procedurally in this case. In this appeal, the appellant is the City of North Richland Hills, the governmental entity. There were a number of people sued. The governmental employees have, for the most part, have been dismissed by the trial court. They're not part of this appeal. They're no longer pending. So we have the governmental entity. We have Jeff Ellis, who was the consultant who consulted with the city with respect to the water park, and he remains before the trial court. And then there's Dr. Yamada, who is a doctor who consulted with the City of North Richland Hills with respect to where the AED should originally be placed. Dr. Yamada filed an interlocutory appeal arguing that he should have been dismissed because it was a healthcare liability claim that was asserted against him and there was no report filed. Justice Dofano was on the panel that heard that. The argument was actually over Texas Wesleyan Law School. This court held that any claims that sounded in healthcare liability should properly be dismissed, but the claims against Dr. Yamada that were not healthcare liability claims, and of course we asserted at that point that deciding where to place the AED was not a healthcare decision, that architects make those, school principals make those, chief justices of courts of appeals may make those with respect to this floor, but at any rate that those weren't healthcare liability claims. That case is currently pending before the Texas Supreme Court, and I argued that case, I think, in May of this year. And so Dr. Yamada is not part of this appeal, and he may or may not be part of the case before the trial court, depending upon what the Texas Supreme Court does. In this case, though, City of North Richland Hills sought to be dismissed on the plea to the jurisdiction at the pleading stage. They produced no evidence, but the plaintiffs did not produce evidence either. So the court has correctly noted it's the pleadings and the pleadings themselves that have to be determinative of whether there are statements and whether there is a claim that properly survives. There were special exceptions filed to the pleadings, but the special exceptions were never heard. So there is, to the extent that there is an argument by the appellant that there's vagueness or that there's more specificity is required, and they've argued that in their special exceptions, but they never heard those, and the trial court never ruled on those. So this court is in the position of trying to determine from the pleadings whether waivers under the Texas Tort Claims Act have been made. Now, a couple of red herrings in the case. The 101-106B, whether the city has consented to suit, that's not before this court per se, because the employees have been dismissed under 101-106E, and so the suit, assuming that there are Texas Tort Claims Act waivers pled, can proceed against the city. I think the recreational use statute is also a red herring in the sense that it does limit liability if it acts, if it operates in this case. I don't think, frankly, that the recreational use statute was designed to control cases such as this one where you operate an amusement park for a fee and invite people in and then take care of their safety. I don't think that's an issue before this court. I think the real issue is whether the two different grounds for waiver under the Texas Tort Claims Act, one is premises, second is the tangible property, condition of tangible property, have been set forth adequately in the pleadings in order to justify a waiver of immunity at this early stage. And then second, does the emergency provision of 101-055 apply and govern in this case? And I will point out that in the defendant's answer in this case, which is part of the clerk's record, I can't recall exactly what page, but I can find that if the court has a question about it, that emergency section is not cited or asserted as an affirmative defense. There are multiple affirmative defenses dealing with sovereign immunity and waivers of immunity and applications of recreational use statute, et cetera, but that particular one is not set forth in there. So I think the court asked a good question. I think Justice Gardner asked a good question. To what extent does the plaintiff have the duty to plead around a defense that hasn't been asserted yet until the appellant's brief? However, we think that the emergency exception does not apply for a couple of reasons. One, and we've set this forth in the brief, the language of that statute talks about as long as the emergency personnel do not violate any law or ordinance. We contend that the common law is a law, and the statute does not say any statutory law or anything like that. It says any law or ordinance. And so certainly the common law has certain standards of care with respect to safety situations that, if violated, would operate to eliminate the exception to the waiver of the immunity. That's the first point. Second point is the emergency statute does not apply if the plaintiff pleads that the actions of the emergency personnel were undertaken with conscious indifference, and that has been asserted in the pleading. In the pleading, the Fifth Amended pleading, plaintiffs have asserted that the conduct of Northridge and Hills employees amounted to gross neglect, which is a constitutional standard, and or gross negligence. And then the plaintiffs cite to the Texas Constitution and Texas Civil Practice Remedies Code 41001, which is the definitional section of the Civil Practice Remedies Code with respect to gross negligence. And this court knows that gross negligence is defined in the Civil Practice Remedies Code. One of the elements is nevertheless proceeds with conscious indifference to the right, safety, or welfare of others. So the pleading on its face, after reciting the facts and the conduct of the employees, the pleading on its face asserts that such conduct was grossly negligent and cites directly to the statutory definition of gross negligence, which includes conscious indifference. Conscious indifference is something that, if pled, bars the operation of the emergency exception. Now, will there be evidence at trial or at a summary judgment hearing as to whether or not these employees were consciously indifferent? I don't know. That's the problem with pleas to the jurisdiction that are so factually dependent as these are. It's difficult for the trial court or for the Court of Appeals to know what the evidence is going to be at this early stage in the game. Obviously, this is a case that has been delayed already by one interlocutory appeal and now is facing another interlocutory appeal. But I think Judge McGrath properly denied this plea to the jurisdiction at this stage in favor of allowing the evidence to be developed and determining whether that evidence exists and whether it would supply the waiver of the immunity. The premises liability claims as pled are very simple. The AED was originally placed at the Green Extreme or Green Monster or whatever it was called. It originally had an AED as a result of the design of the park, the pool consultants, Dr. Yamada's input. It was removed. It was placed back in the offices and, according to the pleadings, was supposed to be a part of but was not the emergency kit response bag that was radioed for that was brought to the scene. So now you have a premise that originally had an AED device at this ride that now does not, and it is located some distance away. I don't know, and the record doesn't reveal how far that is. But you have a premises that had an AED that was there, and it's no longer there. And so the question is, and to what the evidence is going to show is why it wasn't there and whether it should have been there, but the pleadings at least allege that was a defective condition in the premises. Northridge and Hills says, well, we would have to guess where to put the AEDs. And I think that's misleading because I think that they hired people, pool consultants and doctors, et cetera, to tell them where to place them, then they moved them. With respect to the tangible personal property, there was an emergency kit, at least it's pled that there was an emergency kit that was taken to where Sarah Friend was in distress, but it did not contain the AED. This case has been pled like the Lowe's versus Texas Tech case, where the uniform was supplied without the knee brace, or the swimsuit was supplied without the life preserver. In this case, according to the pleadings, there is an emergency response kit that includes resuscitators and oxygen and things like that, but did not include an AED, although they had two. They did not put one in the emergency response bag. That's the allegation that that personal property, which was used, which was taken and used to resuscitate Laura Friend, Sarah Friend, was defective and that it didn't have that necessary component. Those are the pleadings. We believe that Judge McGrath correctly denied the plea to the jurisdiction. We'd ask this court to affirm that ruling.
Can I ask a question? What is it about the green machine or the green extreme that makes it important that the AED have been placed nearby?
I'm going to do my best to answer that question because I've thought about that. First of all, I'll point out, Sarah had not actually ridden the green extreme. So it's not a situation where she had been subjected to some great force and that's likely to cause a heart to stop. She was waiting in line to ride the green extreme. Number two, I've never actually been to this water park. But my suspicion is that the evidence would show if you've got a water park of some certain numbers of acres and you have AED, somebody made the decision to put those in places where they would be readily accessible. And I think what the evidence is, what I gleaned from the pleadings is, they were removed from those locations and taken to some office or somewhere out of the way where people either didn't know where they were or didn't know to retrieve them when they were needed. So I don't think that the pleadings don't indicate that there was anything particular about the green extreme standing in line that would make it a particular place of danger. But I think the issue is whether or not it was defective to have one there. And I don't know if that's in the back area, the front area, or the side area, but you had one there at one point and then you took it away.
Okay, let me see if I've got this straight. So it's like having a fire extinguisher placed different places in a large facility, and somebody decides to gather them all up and stick them in a storage room in the office section, rather than having them spread out, having them in some storeroom, and nobody really realizes they're in the storeroom, expecting them to be spread out like they always had been. The evidence may or may not show that somebody had access to the storeroom where they were stored. Is that what you're talking about?
I think that's it precisely.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cobes. Mr. Quast?
Very quickly, Your Honor, to the extent Mr. Cobes says that special exceptions were asserted, I think I've said in my brief that they have had plenty of opportunity to amend to get all their facts in their pleadings. The case has been pending for 3 years. We're on our fifth amended petition now.
Have they been heard?
Excuse me?
The special exceptions?
I do not believe so, Your Honor.
Do they have to amend before they're heard?
No.
Okay.
The question isn't whether the special exceptions are heard. The Supreme Court has sort of done away with that as an essential prerequisite. The question the court has to ask itself, has the plaintiff been given substantial opportunity to amend after being placed on notice of these issues? Concerning the allegations of the emergency response exception, it is not an affirmative defense, as I stated previously. I used to assume that they were, but the Supreme Court has now told me that they are not, and they are something that they have to plead around. With respect to allegations of conscious indifference, essentially they say, well, we say gross negligence, and that's enough. There are many cases, the Flynn case from the Texas Supreme Court, general allegations, just saying the words gross negligence, that is not enough to satisfy a gross negligence allegation. You have to point to specific facts and show a conscious indifference or reckless disregard. They make the point trying to avoid the emergency response exception that essentially law is common law that can apply. If you apply that to the emergency response exception, essentially the exception or that phrase swallows the rule because there's never an absence of law, because the common law, the ordinary duty of care, always applies. And then it says, it doesn't apply if the action is taken in compliance. Well, to get around that, the only thing you have to do is allege negligence, a breach of a common law duty, not in compliance with the law. Therefore, all you have to do to dispense with the application of an exception to the Tort Claims Act waivers is to allege a tort. And that's essentially this, the exception goes away. It doesn't apply. It can never apply. So that is why the common law, and if you read the cases, they're more looking at statutory law concerning the application of that exception. Concerning lack of integral safety component, they attempt to fit the facts into that line of cases. But, of course, those are older cases, and they have been all but disavowed by the Texas Supreme Court. The precedent has been limited to their facts, limited to when a state actor provides property to an injured party that lacks an integral safety component, and the lack of that component led to the injuries. In this case, we didn't provide the AED to Sarah Friend. We did not provide the radio to Sarah Friend. Essentially, this concept, this doctrine, it's only limited to its facts, and I think the court would be going way out on a limb if it were to extrapolate from those cases. Another thing is I don't see how provision of an oxygen mask or an AED is an integral safety component of an oxygen mask. They're both two different things that do two complementary functions, but it's hard to say that one would be an integral safety component of the other. Essentially, I don't think the facts warrant fitting it under this exception, and the Supreme Court has all but disavowed those cases.
But aren't they really saying that the AED is part of the safety kit or the emergency kit?
Yes, but again,
and there's, I assume, several things in a kit.
Yes, oxygen mask. I believe they talked about airway equipment. Again, Your Honor, those cases have been limited to their facts, and that's what the Supreme Court has told us in Clark and several other cases. If we extrapolate, essentially they say, these cases are limited when a state actor provides property to the injured party that lacks an integral safety component. In other words, we provide a swimsuit without a life preserver. We provide a football uniform without a knee brace. Well, these pieces of property were not provided to Sarah Friend for her use. It's simple. I mean, this can be factually distinguished. The lack of integral safety component should not be employed in this case. Are there any other questions?
I have one more. Bear with me. Is it the city's position, then, that the allegation as to a perhaps faulty location for the AED is that that really is just a question of negligence?
It would be a question of ordinary negligence.
Okay.
But, again, to fit into the waiver of immunity, you need to allege a premise defect.
Okay.
Unless there are any other questions, I'll sit down.
Oh.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. Your case is submitted. We appreciate your arguments and your briefing today. We will proceed to the next.